Welcome to another episode of Zero Ambitions, a podcast about sustainability and the built environment. So for this week's episode, Jeff and I had a conversation with President of the European Straw Building Association, Cyprian Edmonds. Now, the episode was originally supposed to be more about building with straw, but as it played out, the conversation took a slightly different route because Cyprian has a less conventional background for building. Because he's done other things in his life. He didn't just start out in green building or work his way through the construction sector and then decide he wanted to get into green building and sustainability. And I don't know, perhaps echoing that, the conversation meanders away from where he started to how he ended up working in construction. Jeff and I took this opportunity because this is actually a format we've been interested in trying out, speaking with people who come from non-traditional backgrounds who ended up working in the sector. Because they're often more interesting stories than I went to uni and studied civil engineering. And they illustrate the value of diversity of experience. As he later, Cyprian experienced retrofit as a consumer on the estate he lived on, suffering from really poor quality building and really poor quality service. So when he talks about the potential for using a natural building material like straw, emphasising its positive qualities, as well as, you know, its performance qualities, without wanting to sound too pretentious, he has quite a different connection with what he's talking about. So the conversation sort of follows that journey, meandering from where he started, which, just heads up, we talk about music for about 10 minutes. So if you can't be asked listening to any of that, you are missing out, but just fast forward a bit. But we go from that through his experiences dealing with contractors, community organizing, maneuvering through industries, and his ascendance from being an unhappy tenant to being the president of the European Straw Building Association. You know, he has ascended to a place within the establishment of Europe's built environment, albeit a disruptive one. And because of this, I'd argue his voice carries more weight than many of his peers. And you can hear skills acquired elsewhere can be transferred. You know, he's a political operator, which I'd wager he's more informed by his experience working in the cutthroat music industry than training as a joiner or labouring on building sites in his youth. Anyway, we do talk about the value of straw as a building material, the potential of it, why we should be thinking about it, and why we need to be thinking about developing better infrastructure for it. They were a lot of fun. And because we got quite deep into the music stuff, we cut quite a lot of that out. So there are a couple of fragments that might feel a bit disjointed. We just assumed he'd be quite bored by it. Just a bit of housekeeping. Trevor Whatever, the producer and DJ we mentioned, he's a retrofit surveyor, not an assessor, for young people. There's a character I mentioned called Loads of Money with regard to the 80s. He was a caricature of a tradesman who was making loads of money out of being a plasterer. All he really valued was money, and he was an icon of the 80s. I've put a link in the show notes. And lastly, check the Wikipedia reference for straw, because we touched on it quite late on in the episode about what even is it. And so I realised, in spite of having booked it and been reading about it and speaking to John Butler about its carbon qualities, we've not actually identified what straw was or where it comes from. So for context, straw is an agricultural byproduct consisting of the dry stalks of cereal plants after the grain and chaff have been removed. It makes up about half of the yield by weight of cereal crops such as barley, oats, rice, and wheat. It has a number of different uses, including fuel, livestock bedding, and fodder, thatching, and basket making. That's the Wikipedia entry. Curiously, it doesn't mention insulation or as a building material. Happen they need to get onto that. All right, so let's get into it. Thank you for joining us. Cheers.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears. That's the name of a good group. Do you remember them?
Vaguely.
From America, based in America. Really one of those old school from the 70s. Yeah, they'd ask me to sing it, but their biggest tune was, I think it's called Spinning Wheel. What goes up must
That's come it, yes.
Well, yeah.
Endless advert music. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's of a particular era. A lot of crossover, a lot of terrible records as well as...
Yeah, that's always the way, isn't it? You've got some form in this regard, though, Cyprian, don't you? You know, another life that you lead or have led, I don't know, in terms of music?
I have, yes, I have.
I'm just personally interested, you know.
Jeff and I were trying to do a few episodes with people who've come into the retrofit space from strange backgrounds, like oblique backgrounds, because like loads of people have retrained and found themselves getting into this through assessing energy performance, because that was the thing that people could just pick up. You know, it's one of those post-redundancy jobs that someone can get into, fill a hole while they work out what to do next, because the qualification, it's of a reasonable standard and it is achievable. Yeah. There is a demand out there.
He's a retrofit coordinator now, isn't that right?
I think so. Coordinator or assessor. Yeah, Fat City Records. Manchester stalwart. So like 90s to early noughties. I think his album came out in the early noughties. I've got one of his records has always remained in my bag.
Hang on a minute. Sorry, did you just say Trevor Whatever is now a retrofit coordinator?
Yeah. For real.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. I reached out to him on LinkedIn and never got anything back, sadly.
That's an interesting story. That's a very interesting. Yeah, Fat City Records. I remember selling a lot of their products.
Oh, man. They were always my favorite. They were my favorite in Manchester until they closed down. Or I think Jazzman bought them out.
Right. That's correct. That is correct. Are you actually from Manchester?
I'm from Chorley, near Manchester.
Wannabe Manchester.
So yeah. People...
He's a provincial type, really, you know?
Like, I'm from a backwater. Like, a cultural backwater called Chorley.
Cultural backwash, yeah. Exactly.
Famous for Phil Cool, who you may remember, impressionist extraordinaire. Phil Cool. Like, a one-time headliner. Dave Spikey of Peter Kay's Phoenix Knights. Like, Chorley's greatest cultural significance is being part of a joke that Peter Kay made where he described it as being three roundabouts and a netto. And it came to feature quite heavily in Phoenix Knights as a consequence of being Chorley FM.
Okay. There's a really big connection in that. I think my first venture into volunteering in terms of community was as a fundraiser. What we used to do was raise funds for physically handicapped and able-bodied. That's what they were called, PHAB. It was based in South Wimbledon, which is where I am. And we raised money for the members who were unable to raise the funds to go on holiday. But one of the events that we used to do was a comedy night. Joe Brand used to come, and this is going back, oh my God, as soon as you said that, as soon as you mentioned Phil Cool, I was thinking of Joe Brand at the old Leather Bottle on Kingston Road back in the early 90s. No one had heard of her, or other than the comedy circuit, and getting her in to do these gigs, you know, and she was brilliant. She was funny as she is still now. Yeah, Phil Cool, my God, that's a blast from the past. But where's Phil Cool now? Is he still going? What's
I don't know. I think he just disappeared.
He had plastic surgery that killed him. Terrible, is it? Sorry.
He got stuck. couldn't, he couldn't get out of it. So it's right, okay.
Yeah, he was massive for a while.
Yeah.
Absolutely massive. Yeah. Top billing. And then gone. He must have made his money.
Yeah, I think he probably just got really fed up with the industry, because it is a horrible industry. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. Jesus. Right, so back to you, Cyprian. What were you doing in music and radio?
So I worked for Soul Brother Records, which were very similar to Fat City in Putney. And I did that for them for about 7-8 years. Essentially, I went in to just sell records, you know, just a record assistant, so to speak. And I ended up doing a bit of A&R for them. So we had our own record label as well. So we were getting hold of, there was so much independent soul music coming from America, because I think a lot of people just got really upset with what was happening with the major labels. Musicians were just opting to producing and distributing their own stuff. So we were selling their music, you know, their independent albums. But, you know, just thinking, right, hang on a minute, you know, some of these albums have got some corkers on them, and we distributed our own albums. There were the Organic Soul series, I think the three that came out from that. But in addition to that, we also reissued artists as well. So Marlena Shaw.
Yeah.
Wow.
We did no Marlena way. Shaw. Yeah, we did.
She's a giant.
Yeah, I know, right? When I joined them, it was when they first started working on the label. They were a record shop, right? And they then started putting this, their first anthology was to a guy called Leon Thomas, who you may or may not have heard of. He did a lot of work with Ferris Sanders. So I'm talking about really deep spiritual jazz, you know, really out there. And when you kind of put stuff like that out, then what it does, it draws in other artists. And given Marlena Shaw's back catalogue, it kind of made sense to be working with her. We did two volumes for Leroy Burgess, the producer and vocalist from Black Ivory. You know, he did massive songs back in the day. So yeah, I really enjoyed that. But the highlight for me was, you know, really pushing the new labels, the new underground dance labels and that kind of thing. So I was really pushing what people called broken beat, you know.
So,
you know, Detroit techno and, you know, my radio show stemmed off from that. So I was really trying to blend the old music with the new music and, you know, 2 hours of eclectic stuff. I hate that word, but, you know, eclectic.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what you mean.
You're speaking of an era where eclectic became a genre in and of itself.
Yeah.
Thank you, Giles Peterson.
Yeah.
The broken beat aspect, I was a big fan of broken beat around that time as well. It's interesting seeing it. It's had a resurgence as well over the last 7 or 8 years.
It has.
But it's moved out of West London to South London. Like rhythm section.
Well, clearly you know what you're talking about because you've identified the area. You're not just saying what you're saying just for the sake of it. And you definitely go higher up in my estimation now. Yes. So for me, I lived in Northwest London, right? That's why I originally grew up. I lived in just off Westbourne Park. So it was around the corner from where these guys were developing their sound. A lot of them lived in that area. So we had that affinity and they knew I worked for the record shop as well. So I was going down every single week and picking up promos and, world exclusives and all that kind of stuff, you know, properly into it. And also partying a lot in the East End.
Anyway, right, we should probably, I don't know what to do with this bit. I might chop it out, some of it out and stick it at the end.
Yeah.
We'll touch on some of it. It's not going to, I mean, this is a bit more for the heads than for everyone.
It's a different podcast almost, you know, really entirely different.
Yeah. So how did you get from doing that to this?
So I went from, I'm not going to go into detail, but I got into the music from sport. I was a fitness trainer and I really didn't particularly want to do it anymore. And from the music side of things, the reason why that went on the back burner and this escalated, as in my involvement in the built environment, was because of what was going on with me personally, directly. I lived in a tower, which there were three towers on my estate, and the majority of the homes were just, the state of them were just horrendous. And a lot of people now, I'm not saying this wasn't the case then, but a lot of people now are well aware of damp and condensation within the UK, right? Specifically within England, because of the density of housing estates that we have. And I just really, really was becoming concerned, not just from my own perspective and my family, but the residents on my estate were just, it's horrendous. You know, you've got young families who were too ashamed, if you like, to talk about their own particular issues, but also the impacts of not just from their physical health, but how that impedes their interaction with other people. So that meant, like, you know, family members couldn't visit them because their house was so disgusting. And after many years, if you like, of people talking about this and getting really upset, the housing association decided, right, okay, we're going to canvass the residents. And they did this in association with the local authority. We're going to see if we can have a regeneration. You know, fast forwarding to now, I now live in the first phase of that. Works have halted somewhat because of the pandemic and everything else. But it was because of my involvement, if you like, in that community work, because I remember on numerous occasions when the housing association would send a surveyor, quote unquote, who was not necessarily a qualified surveyor. You know, this was to their title. They'd come round, inspect the property and say, right, okay, you want to do this, you want to, you know, all the usual stuff, open up the windows, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of these properties, when I first moved into it, we had fan heating. We didn't have radiators. Okay. So it meant that you really couldn't circulate. And if there was any circulation, you were just chucking the mold and damp all around the property. And through my own investigations, I could see we needed to do something different. And it was through watching an episode of Grand Designs, can you believe it, that I saw Barbara Jones talking about straw building or straw bale building and the benefits of working with straw. And I was doing a construction course at the time, the joinery course, and we got some tickets to go to Eco Build, as that was called then, now called Future Build. And lo and behold, who should be standing in a corner demonstrating how to build with straw but Barbara Jones? And, you know, I said, look, I really want to find out more about this. I want to get involved and try and promote this as best as possible. And she said, oh, it just so happens that Jeffrey Hart, otherwise known as Jeffrey the Natural Builder, is putting together a group to set up Straw Bale Building Association. And that was it. And a group of us met around a table at SPAB's headquarters in London, devising ways how to set up the organization.
SPAB, Straw SPAB. Bale.
No, SPAB is Society of Protection of Ancient Buildings. It's a very, very ancient organization. I think, when was it set up? I ought to know this. 19th century, one of the founders was William Morris. And essentially, the organization, its duty, if you like, or its mission is to promote craft and heritage, more so heritage, not craft, but that's William Morris. But heritage and guidance on all of that. So it was Jeffrey Hart's network was at the time and as is now was really, really good. And he got us a seat in that room. And who was there? Myself, Roland Keeble, Barbara Jones, Mary Rawlinson, Bill Christopher, Jeffrey Newton, who now does work in York through community led housing and others.
And you managed to, when you were watching Grand Designs, I struggle with that show sometimes because of the naked privilege that is never really discussed, you know?
Yes. Oh my God, you're so right.
I think you could say the same of nearly all of the TV property oeuvre. Like,
Yeah.
It's like, a particularly bad example though, because it's sanctimonious too. And I don't know that Kevin MacLeod's doing good work. I don't mean to be disparaging, you know. But it's that kind of the term I use is, if I was being pejorative, it's that kind of dinner party sustainability stuff, you know, like
able
to talk about how good we're being for the planet. Isn't that right, Giles? You know, that kind of...
Yes, and that's what I struggled with too, because my background in the construction industry or built environment, whatever we want to call it, didn't start there. It started as a child because my father was a carpenter and a builder and he had his own firm. But as I said to you, my career has gone from music, from sport to music. And the reason why is because I wanted nothing whatsoever to be involved in the construction industry. I couldn't stand it. I hated it. Every single holiday and every single weekend, and I'm talking about school holiday or weekend, I would be spending my time in my father's DIY shop or on building sites. And I just thought, oh God, this is depressing. I just don't feel it. It doesn't go with me. But interestingly, when I'm in my late or early 40s, I suddenly think, oh, right, okay, I know what I do. I go into the construction industry.
But you come at it from a slightly different angle from retail and labouring.
Yeah.
I served my time labouring and... It taught me a lesson that I definitely did not want to do that for a living. Like, it was an amazing experience. And to be able to do it from a position of privilege where that wasn't going to be my future. Like, I was doing it in my summer holidays. Like, it was a job I could always get. Like, man, there was a lesson there. And it could be a lot of fun, in spite of it being backbreaking work and coming home just filthy.
like shiny some days from not from sweat, but from fiberglass insulation that we were removing from buildings. Like glittering.
You've said something that's really quite interesting there, because I think part of the reason why we're in the mess that we're in this country is because of all of that. You know, my reluctance in my youth, when I could have picked up on a lot of ideas. Can you imagine if I was ingrained in the industry back then and learning the lessons and understanding what I know now, where I could be, you know, or what I could be purporting? There are ups and downs in terms of that particular statement I've just made, because if I was in it for so long, I probably would say, oh my God, I'm depressed, I want to go and do something else. But
you'd be trying to go into music, Cyprian.
Yes, exactly.
That would not be a good look at your age.
Or training for the Olympics, which is 100 days away. Can you imagine? And it's how appealing the industry is to the general public. We've got a big problem in this country about how appealing it is to people. And I'm talking about all diversities.
Well, I think we can blame Blair for that quite squarely. If you think about one of the icons of Thatcherite Britain, like loads of money, he was a tradesman. Like it wasn't strictly aspirational, but like making money was aspirational. So as a means to an end, to do a job, like hearing my partner, her dad was an electrician, and like the money they made on jobs, like there was a lot of things going on, particularly around London, a lot of ways to make money, as it were. They weren't all the work you were doing, but they were related to the work you're doing. Like, oh man, he spoke about it as being really hard graft, but satisfying, and he made his money. And then you have the 90s where the drive to push the primacy of higher education, degree level education, and the diminishment of vocational education, that was something that came to reflect, or it has echoes of the British class system itself, like, and the projection of the aspirant middle classes onto this particular mode of education as being like the only one that really matters. Like I grew up in a household that was formerly working class, if you like. You know, Radio 4 was always on, and I never questioned the idea that I would go to university, and that was it, just all the way through. Like the idea, my uncle ran a demolition company. He was a tiler, and it just never even occurred to me to go into one of those jobs. I always assumed I'd go into a computer job of some kind.
Yes. Well, my family encouraged me to go to university, but you know, I just didn't want to do it back then. And I have to say, the school that I went to didn't really enable us to do that. I won't talk about the school right now because it's riddled in all kinds of controversy. But yeah, I very much get what you're saying. And now, you know, we're paying the price for that, because it means that most tradespeople, and you know, I suffered with this firsthand as a resident, you know, having contractors visiting my property to rid it of damp and condensation, and just the level of workmanship is just absolutely appalling. But number two, the materials they were using, I could see. I thought, my goodness me. And they were just bragging and boasting, oh yeah, mate, this will do. Yeah, this is fantastic. You sort it out for you. I thought, for the love of God, if you're doing this to my property and you're going, and this is a 600 home estate, right? Just consider how many other, and we are not the only estate within that housing association's portfolio. It's one of the biggest in Europe. Just imagine how many properties they're doing that to. And that, again, is the reason why we're in the mess that we're in. It's skilled. And it's a huge cultural shift that needs to happen. Massive cultural shift. And people need to be proud of being, you know, builders.
But it's interesting. We were speaking about this with a construction company up north this morning about their shifting into low energy building. Like, they're looking at Passive House. They just have happened to find themselves working on Passive House buildings. And they have themselves recognized that their staff, they're into it. Like, they've given their staff the training they needed and shown them this new kind of building product. That they've raised their expectations. They've raised their expectations of their own team. And the team's expectations of themselves and the quality of work. And when I was recounting a presentation that Jeff and I put together a while ago, which was about selling Passive House to two people within the construction industry, and like one of the things that we wrote was that we talked about how it will make your workforce happier in their work because they get to do a better job. Like, they take pride in their work. They get to say, we work on world-class buildings.
Exactly. Exactly.
Every fucking building's a world-class building when we've finished with it.
Exactly. Like,
everything changes. Less snagging, less defects, less fewer faults. You don't have to go back to site half as much. Like, they get it done first time because they know why they're doing it and what the impact of their work is.
Yeah. I remember one of the... So regeneration as a name or as a word has got a pretty bad name in this country. It needn't have, but it has. And one of the reasons why is because when a regeneration is delivered, typically what happens is the residents are decanted. I don't particularly like using that word as a word, you know, that sort of
modern.
But, you know, that's what they say. We will decant you to somewhere else. And then what tends to happen or what has happened is that the residents don't return to their homes.
Yeah.
Right. In our case, on my estate, the work is going to be happening whilst we're living here. Right. And it happened in this first phase. And I was living right beside the porter cabin of the team that were working on the site. So I could hear everything that was going on. And I kid you not, everything. And like, you could hear the arguments, you could hear the banter. And some of the things I heard, I just thought, wow. Seriously, wow. I mean, you know, this was happening. It's the 21st century, and I'm thinking, goodness me. I had to write, because I chair the residence group for the estate, I had to write to the team, building team, and say to them, guys, number one, can you just sort out the language you're using? Because we've got kids who live here, right? And who are their parents are a bit offended to hear what you're saying, and they are, because they've asked me to write to you. And number two, the stuff that's going on between your team, can you not talk about it in your quarter cabin as opposed to talking about it to the whole world so we can all hear the disagreements you are having? That level of discontent would not happen if you were working with a group where you felt very happy and the outcome you knew was going to be satisfying. Because for my purpose, or for my experience, I should say, what I've noted with people who work with bio-based materials and people who work on self-build really have a very different mentality to those who are delivering corporate or huge developments. You know, there's a happiness, a joyfulness that goes on. And it's not about nirvana and utopia. You know, let's get a grip here. And, you know, people aren't sat around building fires singing Kumbaya.
you're not tripping over crystals on site.
Yeah.
And that joystick's another fire hazard. Put that out. Like, that's not happening.
Exactly. None of the, you know, these people are professional, you know, and the misconception certainly with straw, building with straw, is that the people who really promote it and build with it, all a bunch of hippies. I could not beg to differ more with that. Because invariably, given the fact that it still is a niche industry within the sector, most of these people can't just ply their livings building straw buildings. They work with other materials or conventional materials, as we would say. So they know how to do it. But they're still a very different set of people, a very different bunch, you know? And I like that.
If this stuff becomes really mainstream, though, Cyprian, the baddies will be using it, you know, and you lose all that cultural stuff. All those benefits, you know, right?
Well,
unless you're saying the materials have magical properties to make people nice.
But you see, the baddies have to be trained by the goodies. That's the thing, right? You can't just go and learn this stuff on the YouTube video. Actually, you can. I do know some people who have built their homes in that fashion, but they've done it on a self-build. But what I'm saying is that if small to medium businesses want to train their in-house teams, right, then they've got to learn of somebody who's been doing it, who's experienced. And invariably, the people I know who are experienced tend to have the right mindset, you know?
Yeah.
There is an interesting challenge at the moment. So we've had a few natural building people, but natural building material people on the podcast. So Sam Bounder from Indie Nature and Chloe Donovan from Natural Building Systems, both of whom have integrated hemp into the products that they're creating. And it's interesting, this tension between industrializing the products and wanting to retain the integrity of the product and all the barriers even to industrializing it. I'm like, you know, when I say industrializing, I'm not referring to the dark satanic mills. I'm talking about introducing capacity and scale, because because you can still produce it locally on a relatively small scale, but you need the economies of scale for the processing. I suppose you need to keep that fairly local with hemp as well. But like, there is this, I've been talking about it every day for the last 3 days. The industry, these many aspects of the industry need to go through a metamorphosis in order to really satisfy the demand that we're trying to cultivate.
Yeah. And to satisfy the certification bodies and so on as well. And the industry in terms of its, you know, how you enable these kinds of materials to win folk over, you know, the barriers, the hoops that you have to jump through in this regard. And these systems are not necessarily designed for, you know, they're designed for a more kind of corporate model where you've got a company that's able to chuck a lot of money into, you know, one company into the development of a proprietary product rather than an approach like straw bale building, where it's, you know, at least up until this point, it's been lots more smaller, more decentralized, you know, in its approach, you know. So that's a tricky one to square.
And I think the trick is to be more open-minded. I'm not talking about on an individual basis. I'm talking about wider society. I don't know why, but I'm conflating this with football for some bizarre reason. You know, footballers decided a couple of seasons ago, before each, and I'm talking about, you know, the bigger teams decided, right, okay, we're going to lead in this respect. And before each game, what we're going to do is take the knee, you know, go down on one knee to demonstrate that we do not condone racism, blah, blah, blah. But it's not football's fault that racism is there. It's society's fault, right? Yeah. So to a small degree, you almost have to wonder, why are you still doing it when racism still exists? But, you know, their take on it is that, no, we have to keep going with it until we can eradicate it. Whether it's working is neither here nor there. But the point you've made about, you know, industrialization, Dan, you know, I 100% agree with you that the challenges that exist aren't necessarily down to the stakeholders per se, the deliverers of it, so the builders and the manufacturers of the materials. It really comes down to it, and this is where we get a bit tasty now. It's down to a bit of politics, you know? It's the politics.
Yeah.
It really is what is happening at central government is really affecting and impacting on what we're doing right now. And it's one of the reasons why the National Retrofit Hub was set up, because the founders of that hub were just so fed up with the slowness of the central parties, whatever color flag you fly, you know, they're saying, oh, yeah, we'll do this. But, you know, you have to bear in mind those people only have 4-year terms, right? But this is going to take longer than that. So you've got to then hope and pray that that particular party will stay in government for another 4 years. And again, that nothing, you know, some silly MP hasn't gone and done something stupid, which means we have another housing minister. We don't, in this country, and I'm talking specifically England, we do not do ourselves any favors in that regard, because we are looking at the wrong decision makers to enable the outcomes that we want. Whereas if you go to France, that's a totally different set of standards and principles and ethics. You know, if the French don't like something, they hit the streets. You know, you saw what the farmers were doing not too long ago. I'm not proposing, in case anybody's listening, that we go and riot. But we have to have a very different mindset to enable change.
Yeah, you know? Well, we've got to get more straw bale people sat next to Robert Jenrick dinner parties. That's the way. That's the way we affect change. Rioting won't work.
Exactly.
It's interesting that you mentioned the National Retrofit Hub. Like, it's worth noting that you're speaking from experience, having been involved in the setup of the National Retrofit Hub.
Yeah,
it's an amazing, it was really amazing seeing their presence at Future Build this year. Such prominence.
Yeah.
Given the stage, so co-chairing the stage with the Retrofit Academy, just seeing that as a proposition, given such a big platform, it felt really significant being there, like being part of it, seeing what was going on. Like a really good array of speakers, and it seemed to have an impact. Like, how did you get involved in that one?
Well,
that's a world away from straw bale and ancient building preservation.
Yeah. So you mentioned ancient building preservation. So the National Retrofit Hub is part of the Sustainable Development Foundation, and I work part-time for the Sustainable Traditional Building Alliance, or STBA. When the hub was starting up, they needed assistance to enable stuff to go on in the background, and I was asked to be a part of that, essentially, because my role in STBA is for communications and events, and so I just transitioned into that. And yeah, I did that for a few months, and it was very interesting to see the way that organization developed, because the goal is to scale retrofit, right? But you can't just do it with just the members of the board. You have to have hands on or feet on the ground to enable that. So the working parties are a great asset, a great tool to enable that. So it was really helping all of that.
It strikes me there's a very interesting link here, Cyprian, between your personal experience of mold and condensation in like tower blocks or in flats, whatever, and the experience that you're tapping into. Are those stories, by the way, we do not hear them anywhere near enough. It's like, it's ridiculous that, you know, the lack of engagement with talking to people living in these kinds of conditions and what their lives are actually like, how it impacts their lives. That's critical. But there's that element. There's the ancient buildings where, you know, a lot of the techniques that would have been used in the past would have been through trial and error, but was developed in ways to manage moisture up to a point. You know, obviously mm-hmm. there's lots that would have been wrong about old buildings in the past too. And then we've got a challenge to retrofit. So in other words, I would have thought you could bring to the table a very interesting perspective on the issues that we can run into where we're using, okay, obviously we're talking, you know, that your real experience might be, I'm guessing, 20th century buildings with shittily built buildings that are being retrofitted in a botched way. But that compared to, you know, and then your natural materials background too, thinking about moisture move into buildings, thinking about what are kind of appropriate solutions in a retrofit context. Is that part of what you bring to the conversation, or is that part of where you come in?
Certainly, well, not for the retrofit perspective, because I don't sit in that field so much at the moment, certainly not within the hub, because I'm not a part of that group at the moment. But the bio-based materials group, if you like, are certainly being asked on a more regular basis about the benefits of applying that type of material in those circumstances, you know, in retrofits. And one of the, certainly within straw, if we're going to use it in this context, if I was to say that, you know, the French were light years ahead of us, they're 30 years ahead of us, right? So the French would happily retrofit a 6-7 story building with straw bales, right?
Wow.
They would happily do that, and they have done it, and I could evidence it for you. But we would never do that in this country because... It's not because of the aesthetics, it's because engineering comes into play, the reduction of foot space, blah, 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 footprint, sorry, right. just comes into play. So people start thinking about the manageability of all of that, and we don't think about the deeper benefits, which means that, number one, you're saving money, number two, it's better for the planet. The retrofit train, if you like, that we're on at the moment, and I'm talking about generally speaking, is great. I'm glad that people are becoming more aware of it. But if I have one criticism just to put out there, is that there aren't enough people who understand it. So I think what is happening at the moment, as is any other trend, given what we were saying earlier about broken beat music coming back into the fray, people or builders are cottoning on to the fact that retrofit is a trendy thing to go with. Oh, yeah, we can retrofit your house. Well, really? You know,
yeah,
have you assessed, have you given it a proper assessment? You know, and should you be doing that? Is that really what's required? That's no fault of anybody who's promoting retrofit in an appropriate fashion. But I just think it's the nature of the beast. People are competitive. Businesses are competitive. And given the fact that not many people understand how to do it, you're going to get, I can't believe I'm actually using this phrase, cowboy builders going out saying, and you know what? I've suffered firsthand on that. Cowboy builders saying, yeah, you know, we can retrofit your property. And they don't know what they are doing. I know they don't, but they're going around hoodwinking people left, right, and center. So the big thing now, I think, will be to see how the work that the National Retrofit Hub has been doing over the past few months, how that manifests itself with the working groups, because I think people are really keen to get out there and to get it done. But it's a slow burner because we've neglected this part of our housing stock. You can't just eradicate all of that within a couple of years, you know, and I think we just need to manage expectations in that.
Yeah, and because so much of the retrofit industry, which is not an industry, has been siloed and working in little communities, like it just doesn't have the, it doesn't yet have the wherewithal to know how to turn itself into a, I don't know, a mass movement or something. Like it's really interesting. Like we've been getting involved in various bits of this. So I'm involved in Working Group 6, which is what is it? The activation. It's the selling retrofit to people part. Like how do you communicate about it? And it's just been a really fascinating exercise. Like, you know, I haven't really said much because it's not really. We've got to hear what all the stuff is that people want to talk about before we can talk about talking about it. And it's been really interesting, like this cacophony of people who, that isn't a criticism, it's just the experience, who come from their specific areas of specialism or entrenched positions or areas of interest or latest need. And you can hear all these voices, like watching the Miro board work in a workshop of like 40 odd people.
Yeah.
Like, oh man, I ain't getting involved. No, not a chance. Like, just leave that be. Leave it.
Yeah, it's dizzying, isn't it? It really is dizzying when you watch and observe all of that. And I remember doing that with ACAN. Sorry to use the acronym of people who are listening who don't know ACAN, or Architects Climate Action Network. And you just, it's like, it's horrible. You kind of see it, you can get dizzy just watching these images just flying around on the screen, and also when you hear the voices too. I would say if I was involved in those working groups, the best level of participation that you would have as an individual is to listen. Just sit and listen. Don't say anything. Unless somebody asks you, don't even put your hand up. Just listen.
Yeah.
Because there's a wealth of interest in those groups. But I tend to find that, as in any other group, and this is no offense meant to the Hub, any other group, you always find that there are people who just pipe up and just talk a lot of crap. And so this is what I've done. I've done this. Yeah, you want to do it that way. And it's because, you know, it's human nature to do that, isn't it? Right?
Yeah, especially men. And then you're talking to two of them now as well. So there's that. we should be, except from, it strikes me we should be talking, I mean, straw bale and retrofit are uncommon bedfellows, at least. We should be talking more about straw bale in the context of new builds, really, as well, because that's where I presume a lot of your emphasis is. And if we've got a very limited kind of carbon budget that we can permit for new build, bearing in mind how screwed we all are, then it's sort of incumbent on us to use the least polluting, the least kind of harmful resources we possibly can for the new build that we do have to build, right?
Should we explain what we mean when we say straw bale building at all? Because we haven't even touched on that. Please. Well, you're the president. You're the boss of Europe.
He's in charge of all the straw in Europe. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Yes. Yes. So straw bale building, which is the concept of that, initiated in Nebraska in America. Right, many, 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 many moons ago. And over here in the UK, we have done a bit of it, but not as much as we would like. So when people talk about working or building with straw, there are two types of building. So specifically, the most common I'm talking about. So there's thatching, right? So applying straw to your roof. Or there's using straw as an insulation property within your build. What we are seeing at the moment is there is a growing desire to work quickly. And for us in the UK, you know, we're constantly being told that we're in a housing crisis and we need more homes. We need new builds. And so who's going to develop that? Who's going to put that out there? The ones who have that gift, for want of a better word, typically I would say are those who are aligned to local authorities, so social housing. And I'm talking about, if we're going to talk about affordability, but astonishingly, they haven't really grasped the metal in that regard. So they would tend to work in the old typical conventional way, you know, bricks and that. They're not even considering MMC, modern methods of construction. So the simplest argument that I would have to any major housing developer is, look, and it's much like what you said earlier, Dan, you know, if you're going to satisfy and make the occupant happier, surely the simplest way of doing them, besides giving them free Wi-Fi, is to give them a house, or a property, a flat, that is energy efficient. Because a considerable proportion of your income goes through the, certainly within the property, goes from that. You know, if you have a house that is built solidly and it's not leaking heat, and if you flip that over, conversely, you're not cold in the winter, then it's happy days. You know, you as the person, the occupant who's living in that house, is going to be happier. So I would say that it's not difficult to manage, because if you're a carpenter and you're working for a major housing developer, if you're a contractor who's working for a major housing developer, it's the easiest thing to do. It's like building with Lego, you know. The most difficult thing, and this is where we are having the issue or the problem in this country, is manufacturing it. I can count on one hand how many companies in this country are mass developing straw panels. But if you go to Europe, it's a different kettle of fish. In France, they just seem to be pouring out of their ears and every orifice. In this country, we don't have that. And it's a mindset that which we need to turn over and just get on with it, because it's so easy.
So we're talking about straw bale or straw building within a panelized system. So straw is the filling, the insulation. Like, how much of it is the structure?
It's a considerable.
How does it even work? To be honest, I can conjure.
How do you build a straw panel?
Yeah.
Well, you've got your two. You know, you've got your wood. You've got your panels, and you just literally just glue them onto the straw. You fill up the panels right with straw, and you literally just take them away. You take them away on your crane, and that's referring to the straw panels, right? And you drop them onto the site that you're working.
So we're not talking about like building an igloo with the seating arrangements from a country fair. This isn't like literally straw bale. This is
structural timber there too.
Yeah.
You know. Yes, there is structural timber. Yeah. But that's within that specific system. So if you're talking straw bale, then, you know, you have your timber frame and your straw bales, which you've gone and acquired from Farmer Sam down the road, especially if you're thinking environmentally friendly, because you want to make sure you're getting the right kind of straw too. I would say that for the future, and going back to what we were referring to, grand designs, for the future, and the present, but certainly for the future, straw panel system is the way forward. Because I think if you're building with straw bales, it tends to take a lot longer. You need to have the experience on how to do it, because you can't just go and buy your bales from somebody down the road and just plonk them in your field. You've got to store it properly so that they don't become moldy. Because what happens thereafter is that you've gone and ruined the build from the get-go. It's like, you know, the air breathing test that you would have, right, that you can have. It's advisable for you to bring those people on board from the get-go. You don't build your house and then bring in this bloke to come and see how great your house is, because you've gone about it back to front. And similarly, if you're going to acquire bales to build your house, you've got to make sure that they're sound and secure, and they're covered up and no rain gets onto it, etc.
So if you're thinking about building with bale, which is always, whenever anyone talks about building with straw, that's the image that was conjured in my head. Stack them.
What image?
Yeah. When you talk about building like Lego as well, like that, it sort of fixed that image in my head. But it's like, so building with bale is a more complex supply chain than the slightly more industrialized process of using straw as the insulation material within a panelized system.
Yes.
So much like we were speaking about with Chloe last week, where they use hemp, straw is an equally useful building material.
And
I take it, I think it's interesting that one of my go-to embodied carbon experts, John Butler, is, he's coming at it from the perspective of a independent, life cycle assessment consultant who, in those terms, praising materials and build systems based on embodied carbon, is a massive advocate of straw bale. And it kind of stands to reason because, we're talking about materials here, whatever approach you take to them, that require remarkably little energy to be used in the processing of them to turn them into a finished building. Right?
Precisely.
That's a fundamental part. Before you even get into the sequestration point, how much carbon is stored in the materials, you have this massive advantage as we move into thinking about embodied carbon in that it's just... Yeah, you don't have to burn. You don't have to run kilns and fire kilns and so on. And you don't have to extract things from beneath the earth's surface and so on to refine them to make this stuff.
Yeah, it's not rocket science. It really is not rocket science. And I'm baffled because of the simplicity. I think people are baffled by it, not just me, because of the simplicity. I know a number of builders who don't work with straw. They work with conventional materials. And when I speak to them about it, they look at me and they do that thing that dogs do. Have you ever talked to a dog and it cocks its head to one side? I'm taking a bit out of builders now. I don't know where we're going to go with this. But yeah, they cock their head to one side and go, "You build with straw?" I said, "Yes." "Well, how do you do that then?" And he explains to them the process. And I go, "Oh, right. Okay. Well, where am I supposed to get that from?" So it comes down to the supply chain, and this is the reason why the new build part of our sector is in a bit of a mess, because it does not enable those who want to build in a sustainable fashion to do so easily. Where are you going to get straw from if you're in central London to build straw bales, to build, let's say, an estate? You've got to scratch your head and think about, right, okay, where's the nearest farm? Have they got the right kind of straw for me to do this with? And it should be as easy as going down to, I'm not going to mention name, but the massive merchants, builders merchants that most people go to. And just going and get a bit of 4B2. It should be as easy as that, but it's not, and that's because we haven't set that system up in this country.
I think it's also important to emphasize there is this old train of thought, kind of tired old trope, that you have on one hand highly insulated, airtight buildings like passive house, and then on the other hand, natural building that's like straw bale, and never the twain shall meet. But we've seen examples now to disprove that, right?
It's
starting to kind of, like we featured one in George McKerchick, if that's how his surname is pronounced, is passive house in Hereford, So is that an annoyance that you have to contend with, that people, think of this straw bale as not being, it's like an old school green building thing from the 80s or 90s, rather than something that can help us to achieve very demanding energy performance targets?
Yes. Besides the, and I swore I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to, besides, all of the silly Three Little Pigs and all that kind of stuff.
That comes out
from people. People seem to think that this is not something that, this is not a system you can't integrate with another. So you've just illustrated the passive house example. I think it was One Planet Development in Wales. I know the guys who did that, Jonathan Davis, and, you know, working with Phil Christopher and Hufflepuff and Auckland. If you want something to be done, then you can fuse or join those ideas together. Passive House System is a brilliant way to work, as is working with Straw. And if you have people who understand the science, then they can manipulate it to do so. And that house is incredibly energy efficient.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have been sitting on, I have been waiting for an opportunity to say, Cyprin, for God's sake, this sounds like the stuff of fairy tales. You're going to be suggesting stick building next or something along those lines. I've another one about biodiversity and the proposed reintroduction of the wolves to the UK and what that might mean for straw building, but I don't know if we'll get to use that today.
No, don't ask me about wolves.
Oh, yeah.
my knowledge only goes so far. I can talk to you about music, sport, and straw, but wolves, no.
Yeah.
Dogs and cats, I can do that.
There is a recurring theme which we use that an architect called Cedric Burgers, a passive house architect who we interviewed last year, gifted us in that he described a building performance in terms of energy reduction is the apex predator of building design.
Mm.
If you build a building to reduce the energy demand of the building, it changes the whole ecosystem of the building. In the same way, the wolves being reintroduced to Yellowstone Park.
Yeah.
Change the whole ecosystem for the better. So, for instance, you build a passive house, better air quality, better comfort levels, more resilient building because, uh-huh, you know, it needs less maintenance, blah, blah, blah. All in the same way, the wolves reduce the deer population, which increased the trees, which brought back the beavers, which changed the waterways, which created more fertile land, blah, blah, blah. But, I couldn't
and
quite
the,
find
the
a
other
way.
Thing is, so in terms of the wolves in that regard, so here's one that we need to, the big elephant or the big wolf in the room, ventilation systems, you know, mechanical ventilation systems, are they necessary? You know, I was on a talk a couple of weeks ago and this guy was saying how they built this house with hemp, right? Very energy efficient, and there is no need, given the insulation factors, the high insulation factors and the high energy efficiency of that site, he didn't see it necessary to add any ventilation to it, which is great, which is fantastic. And I think this was in Italy, right? But one of the myths that people have about working with fire-based materials is that it's not necessary full stop. You know, the example you gave about that property in Wales, the passive house straw panel built. No, sorry, not that one. It was Uri's house in Hereford, his own house. So the guy who was the guinea pig for EcoCocon, he has a mechanical ventilation system within his house. Now, why would he do that if he didn't think he was going to benefit from it? You know, he's an architect, he's a qualified architect, and he knows very much about, he understands 100% about that building system, as in the panels, because he's their technical advisor. But he wanted it just to up the ante, if you like, knowing pretty well that the overall capacity for that house would benefit him and the environment on the whole.
I mean, it's a requirement of the passive house standard to have a certain number of air changes per hour. And in fact, I mean, it's something I need to pick up on with the Institute. Ventilation is a really tricky one. Mechanical ventilation doesn't sound nice. Natural ventilation sounds nice, right? unless you're into robots and stuff, you know. But I mean, the last I checked, air cannot read, you know, a schematic or a map. Like it can't see where it's supposed to go. Natural ventilation is lovely in principle, and there can be circumstances in which it can work, but it's limited and it's arbitrary. It'll depend on factors that you cannot legislate for, like the weather, for instance, and the topography of a site and so on. It's complicated. And when we look at post-occupancy data at monitoring studies on different ventilation strategies in buildings, we can't find consistent examples of natural ventilation working reliably well. That's the nub of the problem, you know. Sorry, my kids have just walked in the door because I'm doing this podcast from home, so I'm going to have to try and run away and rejoin in a second if you're still okay. Knocking about.
Yeah, yeah.
You can hear the dog and the kids going mad.
Okay. And then you're all right okay. for now. Right, so looking at your position as the president of, is it the European Straw Bale Association?
Straw Building Association, yeah.
Straw Bale Building Association, yeah.
Straw building. Straw building.
Right. Yeah. Sorry. I it's wrong in my notes, so apologies for that. What is it you guys are doing then? Because I think something you've described, we've heard described repeatedly, is that it's difficult to do in terms of finding the skills training and a reliable source of materials. Like it's yeah. not easy. So is this something that you guys are doing or...
Obviously, because of the name in itself, it's representing the associations around Europe. So you have the Polish, the Dutch, the UK, the French, Spanish, and there are others who are going to be joining. We've just recently had the Norwegians join us too.
So what is it that the European Straw Building Association is setting out to do? Is it there to mitigate some of the gaps in delivering the supply chain, like making a supply chain be vital so people who are interested in it can actually access it? Or are you like a political mover?
Yeah, I'll tell you first and foremost, my role, and you've just touched on it really, is more like a political mover, networker. That's my role. Yeah, I'm not going around building properties. The others in the associations who are well equipped to do that, well qualified to do that, are actioning that in itself. The role of the association is to not just galvanize the efforts of all those respective independent associations, but to be the voice for it. Because Europe in itself is a continent, right? So, you know, we want to be the voice for the continent. But one of the, there are a number of things that we are working on at the moment, one of which is to build a European standard for straw building. There isn't a standard in the UK other than what we have put out. So we've put out a technical guide. It's free within the UK, but there isn't typically a standard in that regard. And all the other countries, or most of the other countries and their associations, are more or less the same. And we're talking to the EU Commission to see how we can pull all of those ideas together so that there's one driving voice to move forward. You talk about also the supply chain, and we touched on that a little bit earlier about the absence of that within the UK. Well, in some cases, in some countries, it's the same. You know, in France, it's not. They can literally do what they want as and when they want. But again, I'd say they're 30 years ahead of everyone else, you know?
Yeah.
So they have a supply chain that's more robust than everyone else, you know? But yes, it's really bringing uniformity towards the continent. That's what we want to do, so that anyone who joins their own respective country, they understand, right, this is how we're going to work. This is how it's going to happen. Of course, we want autonomy. You know, we're not going to say, we're not going to dictate to people how they should do stuff, but it's understanding how one system works in one country would work in another, you know, and that goes in accordance also regarding the education. There's a program called STEP, which stands for the Straw Building Training for European Professionals, and that is recognized within Europe, but we would like for that to scale so that people can say, right, I have worked with that, so you could go and work with it here in the UK, and if you wanted to go and work in France or Poland or Norway, you say, right, I've done my STEP course, fine, come on board, and you can come and help us build our straw building.
Excellent. And if you've got links for that or any of those aspects of what you're doing, sling them our way. We'll stick them in the show notes so we can we can put all of the links to these things in the show notes.
So
from a European perspective, like getting a continental mission together, as it were, like building continental credibility, that's serious. Like that's a magnificent thing. And it can be pulled off. You've seen it with bricks. Timber frame as well. Like timber frame hasn't always been as accepted a proposition for building domestic homes everywhere. How focused on the UK are you as a market, or Ireland even? Because they're our main listeners. Like,
very, very much so. You mean from the European perspective or from me personally?
Well, both. Whatever's interesting, to be fair.
So from a European perspective, yes, because you want to know that your neighbour is on the same page as you. You know, you don't want to feel that you're charging forward. So the French were not members of the European Straw Building Association last year for one reason or another. And I spoke to them and said, look, guys, you're the leaders of this. It's a bit like having Live Aid and not having Bruce Springsteen on there, or not having, you know, David Bowie on it. You say, hang on a minute, you guys, you're the ones who made rock music what it is, you know, get on board, you know. So I brought them on specifically because we want to learn from their experiences.
I hope you're not characterizing yourself as mid-year in this analogy.
No, because what's even better, I'm definitely not characterizing myself as Bob Geldof. You know, he has that moment where he plays on the tables, give us your fucking money now. But I have to say, there are moments where I have wanted to do that. You know, seriously, some people just drive you up the wall. But you know, from a UK perspective, or how that looks into what's happening in Europe, we've really, really got to pull our fingers out, because we're lagging behind. But we're not lagging behind because we don't have the knowledge. We have the knowledge in this country, but it's a case of scaling it to the degree you have the high level of confidence. You know, we want to have that. You know, the French, I keep talking about the French all the time, but the French straw building, yeah, we do that. You know, over here in this country, if somebody were, and I'm talking in the UK, if a major housing developer approached, and I'm talking about a major housing developer, approached a straw builder with a view to developing or building their homes, I'm not entirely sure, I couldn't give you with a great degree of confidence, if the housing developer would get it, principally because we haven't worked to that scale in this country.
Yeah.
You would have to really work together to enable that to come off. And I'm not talking about structurally. I'm talking about all the other parts that come with it. I'm talking about the planning, etc. So, you know, I'm being honest. I'm not telling it, you know, I'm not downgrading or downplaying where we are in this country, because we've got the talent, we've got the science, and we can do it. But I just think that we need to be more professional in terms of our output and our outlook as well.
There is strength, figuratively, in it as a material, but not in the industry around it. You know what I've just realised? What crop is straw? Because you don't plant straw, do you?
No. So it's interesting you should say that, because the European Commission, I think about 2-3 weeks ago, said that it is a byproduct, right? And the European farmers disagreed with that. And I don't know if I should be saying that, because that really throws things out. But they're saying it's a waste. So we need to have that, again, it's the messaging and how that comes about. Because one of the things I have found difficult, certainly within the past year, is really talking to the main decision makers within the farmers' unions, you know, and understanding. Because, you know, we're going to get their straw from their members, right? From the farmers' unions. So it would be sensible, in my opinion, to say, right, guys, we need to have a conversation. You know, we want your straw, right? And we want to work with this. And we also understand that, I understand that farmers are having a particularly difficult time in this country anyway, in terms of managing their income. If you were to have a conversation with them so that both sides win, in terms of the overall outcome, then again, it helps to speed up the process, you know, because farmers are then promoting that to the construction sector. At the moment, I don't even think that conversation has been had.
Yeah, there is a strong case to be made for it as a byproduct.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And it's not like you don't have a risk involved in that. Like, sort of, there is a risk of exploitation when you classify something as something. So, like, I was minded to think of the milk industry, the dairy industry. Yeah, dairy industry. Milk industry is not the right way of framing it. Because it's the cream industry. That was where I was thinking. Because milk is sold at a loss because cream is a commodity that is sold at a profit. And the supermarket supply chain infrastructure drove the price down on the farmers to the point where, I mean, dairy farming has in many cases been made totally unsustainable as as an economic practice because of the pressures they've been put on them.
Dan doesn't like dairy anyway, just for the record, except for cheese a little bit of cheese.
I just don't eat cooked cheese. Like, once cheese has gone past room temperature, it is dead to me. I will not touch it, even if it returns to a temperature that is lower than room temperature. And I say room temperature because some rooms are warmer than others. I don't mind if a cheese is sweating. I just won't touch a pizza.
Some rooms are warmer than others. That sounds like a Morrissey song, that does. The Smiths.
But yeah, there could be a risk of, there is risk in developing infrastructure where something gets classified as waste, people get a great price for it, infrastructure builds up around it being classified in that manner, and then all of a sudden, other nefarious players recognise its value and say, I'm having that. Fuck those guys. And then an industry could be killed in the way that milk itself has been turned into a byproduct. And a loss-making exercise, but the dairy farmers have to get rid of it somewhere and they can't be pouring it into the fields.
I mean, it comes down to, you know, if we're looking at, certainly from a farmer's perspective, land requirement, you know, for our perspective and the farmers, it's the land requirement, right? So what I said, we need to have that conversation with them. You know, it's a case of what do they get out of it, as in the farmers? You know, do they use their land to develop food or do they use their land to develop low grade? And how does that benefit for them? Again, that conversation, to my knowledge, has not been had on a wider, deeper level. And that's one of the conversations we need to have with them, because if we're going to use straw in that regard, i.e. we're going to be using their supply, their land, to develop where we're at, then they are part of the equation. They are a stakeholder, right?
Yeah. Right. Is there anything you haven't had a chance to talk about today that you wanted to?
Plug. I need to plug something.
The floor is yours. Yeah. Crack on.
So Straw Bale UK is very happy to announce that we will be having our first conference event in many years. Our conferences tend to be online. We've had a number of series on webinars online, but we're going to be having our first event in Swansea on September the 12th, to be precise. That's Thursday, September the 12th, and it will be at the University of Wales. And I need to get the press release out just to formally tell you guys what it is. So the event is a straw building symposium. It's Biophilia, Nature's Blueprint. Yeah. And our first, I'm not going to say, but we've got a big keynote speaker who's going to be speaking. Love to give you an exclusive, but I think I should save that.
You can remain enigmatic. That's okay. Yeah.
So what it will explore is the principles of biophilic design, highlighting its impact on architecture and human experience. And we'll have experts discussing elements such as maximizing natural light and ventilation and vegetation and using natural materials and embracing biomorphic forms and patterns.
Interesting.
Right.
Cool. All right. Well, anyone who's interested in any or all of those aspects, check the links that will be in the show notes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Mon.
Thank you very much.
It's been a lot of fun. Sadly, I think we'll have to edit out some of the meandering, because there's no sense in subjecting everyone to our dissection of the West London broken beat scene of the late 90s and early noughties. But if anyone who is listening wants to get in touch and talk about it, holler at us. I'm sure we'd be happy to get into that another time. Anyway, right. So thank you so much. Thank you for joining us at home. All the usual things. Join ACAN, join the ECB, join the IGBC. Women out there, check her on Space. All those links are in the show notes. Subscribe to Passive House Plus magazine. The Plus does a lot of heavy lifting. It's not just about Passive House. It covers all sorts of things around high performance building, retrofit, blah, blah, blah. Check the website. It's there in the show notes. Advertise if you can. If you need to advertise, it is an amazing vehicle to do so. Talk to us at the consultancy. Again, links in the show notes. And please share the podcast far and wide. If you get some out of this, you probably know someone else who will as well. So please share it with them. And, oh yeah, review and all that stuff. Like, 5-star, please. Anything else, Jeff? You got anything to plug?
I've got no. No, not really. No, I'm going to shut up now. Yeah. Thank you, Sirpin. Thank you for doing this. It's been great.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, guys, for the opportunity. It's been fun.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. All right. Thanks for joining us. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.